I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran, opening a reverb store in the vain hopes of selling your 7 rack mount reverbs from the 1980s, or else a scrappy upstart, using algorithms to mix and master your entire stereo bus. This is your show, because ultimately it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, this week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Salvatore who drove a Chevy Tahoe with 200,000 miles on it that he bought at a police auction. And old Salvatore, he would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now. You guys, that's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code TWSEPK when you sign up for the new EPK plan. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Currently, only the latest 100 episodes are available in iTunes and Spotify for free. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded for streaming and for download. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault, become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month, and for your generosity, you'll also receive access to all of that content. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I get it, but there's still a few ways for you to help us out for free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. Today's artist on our program is a very old friend of mine and who is long, long overdue to be a guest on our program here. He's a lovely guy and an absolutely killer songwriter, and I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Our guest this week hails from Delavan, Illinois. Cody Dekoff, better known as Chicago Farmer, grew up in a small farming community before moving to Chicago in 2003. Over the past two decades, he has built a devoted following through relentless touring, first as a solo performer and more recently with his band, The Field Notes. Along the way, he has shared stages with Robert Earl Keane, Todd Snyder, Greg Brown, The Wood Brothers, Elizabeth Cook, Wayne Hancock, Green Sky Bluegrass, Del McCurry, and many others. His album Flyover Country was recorded with the members of the Band of Heathens, and this year's album, Homemade, is his first release in 6 years. Elmore Magazine says that he has the novelist's gift of building a suspenseful story to a surprising conclusion. No Depression declared, "If the Midwest is looking for a voice, the search is over." As I mentioned before, Cody is a very, very old friend of mine. We were both coming up in the Chicago folk music scene 20 years ago. He's one of my favorite modern artists, and he should have been on this podcast years ago by now. I got a chance to catch up with him over the phone to hear about his musical journey so far. You were mentioning there the name Chicago Farmer and how you were kind of ambivalent about it for a while, but it does really get to the heart of this kind of Midwest music that you make. We met in Chicago in the early to mid 2000s, and we were both doing that scene, which I want to get to in a moment. But what's really interesting about your work and your life is where you originally come from. Most people across the country, when they think of Illinois, they think of Chicago, but Chicago is the outlier in Illinois. The rest of Illinois is one of the most agrarian kind of small town, places in America, and that's where you're from, Delavan. Can you kind of describe to people what your childhood looked like culturally?
Yeah, it was a town of 1,700 people, and all my grandparents were farmers who came from a long line of farmers. I kind of took a different path, so did my dad. My dad was kind of a free spirit guy. He owned a head shop when he was pretty young and helped put on concerts and stuff like that. My mom was a teacher and a speech therapist. So came from very humble beginnings. And I spent a lot of time on the farm working for my grandpa and getting to know him and getting to know his stories. And Delavan was a small town with no stoplights. And you were just constantly, as a kid, kind of looking for things to do. When you were young, you just get to run around, and you know, my mom would come out on the front porch and just yell my name when it was time for dinner. It was kind of life like that. And then when you get older, you get a little more bored and you're looking for more things to do. Kind of like that old story. And so I had this thing called study hall, and I had a lot of them. We were a small town. We ran out of teachers. Sometimes we ran out of money. We never consolidated with other schools, though. We stayed on our own. But I started writing in study hall. I used to go on little adventures in my head. And when I would get back from those adventures, I started writing them down. And then I started kind of adding characters. And then I took some money from Balen Hay and got a guitar and kind of been doing it ever since.
So it was stories at first, or it was lyrics before you got that guitar?
It was definitely lyrics. There were these kids in the back of study hall, and they didn't seem like the studious type, but their pencils were going 100 miles an hour. And they had like blue hair and, you know, shirts on that said Iron Maiden and Metallica. And I went in the back of the room and I realized they weren't studying at all. They were like drawing, and they were drawing things that were similar to like the images on their t-shirts and stuff. And so I tried my hand at drawing and just realized this is not my thing at all. So, but I kept hanging out with them and I started writing. And so, yeah, it was just kind of stories, and then kind of turned into poetry and limericks, and just hung out with those guys. And that was the first time I realized I had like a creative bone in my body. And once I realized I had a little bit of creativity inside of me, I couldn't stop. And then later the guitar came along and kind of helped put those little limericks and that little poetry into motion.
That's a real revelation at that age, when up until that point you've just been consuming art and culture, and then you make you make something. It's a real crossing of the Rubicon at that point. There's no going back. And
absolutely,
it can be hard to remember like what an earth shaking moment that is for all of us.
Yeah, I really was. I just kind of had this fire in me. And I remember pretty much immediately telling my parents that I wanted to be a writer and a musician, knowing nothing about it. But like I said, after just, you've got a song about, I don't mind driving around. That's what we did in high school. We drove around, and I was always looking for something. I didn't know what it was. And then these words started falling on a page, and I was like, okay, this is it. And just kind of, and that fire still kind of burns. But man, when you first realize like what a couple chords are on a guitar, when you first like write two lines that connect to each other back in the day when you're first starting out, that's a feeling really tough to beat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't go back and listen to a recording of it because you haven't recorded anything yet. You just want to get your hands on a guitar so you can play your little thing that you make.
Absolutely. Just kind of start tinkering around and figuring it out.
When did you start putting the songs in front of people?
I started a little band in high school, and every year we had a little carnival. It's called the Fall Festival, and they had a little talent show. And so we would practice in the basement, and then we would go play the talent show. And I think there were three performers, and we got beat. There was a girl who sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow. She didn't know all the words. And then there were these other two guys that, they were two farmers. They shot mini marshmallows out of their nostrils across the stage. And we took third place to those two acts. And that's when I knew right away this wasn't going to be easy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of crazy how close our job is to just like a straight up early 20th century, like carny lifestyle.
Absolutely.
It was... like I was well into my career, like 10 years into my career, had stuff written about my music in reputable magazines, had done cool stuff. And yet I was somewhere in, Idaho playing like directly before like a chili eating contest, And if it if it paid well enough, I would go do that again tomorrow,
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So at what age did you make, how old were you when you made your way to Chicago, and what brought you there?
It was in 2003, and I didn't leap so much from that small town straight to Chicago. I had moved to, in the late 90s, into Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, after bumming around a bunch. But that's really where I found like my first music scene. I played the two bars in my hometown in everybody's backyard. So I went to Bloomington, Normal, where Illinois State is. And there were several bands that were really great. And that's when I first started like really witnessing live music and feeling the power behind that. And, being from Delavan, there were maybe two or three musicians in the whole town. But now here I was surrounded by people my age who had new ideas and new forms of creativity, and who were kind of like speaking out and had different views. They were coming from Chicago and all over country really to this college. And I didn't last long in college, but it was very memorable. And that's kind of where I decided to go all in. I think in that study hall, I realized I wanted to be a writer and musician. But when I got to Bloomington Normal and immersed myself in the music scene was when I knew I wanted to go all in with music full time. And then I had some guys that I lived with. They were called the Herbert Weiser Band. And in 2003, for various reasons, they moved to Chicago, and I decided to join them about a month or two later, just to see what was up there. And There were seven of us in one loft apartment next to the double door. It was a three bedroom apartment, and we went to Home Depot there on North Avenue, and we got some supplies, and we turned that three bedroom loft into like a six bedroom loft.
Yeah.
And splitting the rent, you know, seven ways, I was paying about the same much amount of rent as I was in Central Illinois somehow. So I was able to survive off of playing music in Chicago, which was just insane to me really at the time.
See, this is where people realize that the hipsters from small town Midwest are different than the urban hipsters, because you guys go to Home Depot and frame out your loft immediately.
Yeah, it was pretty great. And the guy who owned the loft was pretty cool about it, because he went from having a three-bedroom loft to a six-bedroom loft. So everybody won, you know?
Yeah. Man, I mean, looking back now, there was a real, not only a scene, but an infrastructure in town for small original music back then. You mentioned living next to the Double Door, where there was the Double Door. And there was Subterranean, and there was, a host of places that were small. There's still Uncommon Ground, which is still there. Martyrs, which is still there.
Yeah.
Lilies. I mean, I just can't imagine at this point that even Chicago, but many towns, have as robust of an infrastructure for small-time original music anymore.
Yeah, it was a special time for sure. And like I said, being from a town of 1,700, it was pretty overwhelming, but it was equally exciting and inspiring. And yeah, there was also a place right there across the street called the Filter.
Yeah.
Filter Coffee
Filter
House.
Coffee. Yeah.
And man, I would go there and write songs all day, man. I would just write songs all day. And then at night I would go play them somewhere. And, you know, maybe it was like somebody's living room or, you know, a place where you go knock on the door, like an underground little speakeasy where you gotta have a password or something. But there was just poetry slams and open mics and gigs everywhere, and everybody in Wicker Park in the early 2000s was carrying an instrument or covered in paint or something, you know. And so I fell in love. I was still scared to death being a small town kid, but man, I loved it. And everybody was cool. Like everybody was, you know, it wasn't like a cutthroat thing for me. Everybody seemed very helpful. And, you know, if you sucked, they wouldn't tell you sucked to your face. And if you were good, they would throw you a bone. And that was great.
Man, you know, I moved there in 2005 and I spent many days in Filter as well, writing songs. Yep. So I think that there's well above like a non-zero chance that we were in there at the same time writing tunes.
I would assume, yeah, before we actually met. And
yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's wild.
It pains me to report that I think it's a Bank of America now, and you know, Double Door I think is REI or Yeti or something. But man,
Double Door's gone too. I knew Filter was gone while we were still living there. That went early, but Double Door hung on for a long time.
Yeah, it did.
I'm about to interview an artist later today, and I was checking out their tour schedule, and I'm happy to report that they're playing Sub T next month.
Nice.
So Sub T's still very holding cool. on.
That's great, man. That's great.
It was a different scene. That you mentioned how people were kind of helpful in a way. And I remember when I was in my early 20s visiting friends who were kind of in an art scene in New York, and it seemed a little, not holier than thou, but cooler than thou there. Like you had to be real cool to be doing what was happening in New York. And I did not feel that in Chicago. I didn't feel like you had to be real cool, part of the cool kids table to do it.
Right.
And that's good, because I'm never going to be a part of the cool kids table. So I needed to go to a place where that wasn't a requirement. And Chicago was great for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't believe, really, you know, being from where I was from, kind of more of a rural upbringing, that there was a lot of like country music and roots music and Americana music being played. I remember stumbling into a place called The Hideout, which I'm sure you remember, and a band called Devil in a Woodpile playing in the corner. And, you know, my friend had taken me to this place called The Exit, which was on North Avenue, and he kind of took me there as a joke, taking this country kid to the exit. And I think it might have been like an S&M night or something like that. Everybody was in leather and spikes, and I walked in, you know, this little country kid, and we had a good laugh about it, you know, and everybody was kind to me. And then we stumbled over to the Hideout and saw this little neon light, and I walked in there, and there was like a jug band playing country music, and I was like, wow, this is I think I can live here. This has got a little bit of everything here. And so I immersed myself. But yeah, there was a great scene and great variety. I remember Cornmeal was kind of the bluegrass band at the time. You know, obviously Wilco and Umphreys were really, you know, doing their thing on full speed and things like that. And then you were the songwriter guy of the time. You were, you know, making these young kids, you know, hang on to your every word and these spots. And it was beautiful, man. It really was. And it was a crazy time too, you know, early 2000s, right after 9/11 and everything. Everybody was just trying to, everybody was full of questions. And I think the music, you know, at least gave us a few answers.
Very interesting time post 9/11, pre financial crash. Right.
Yeah.
When things really get shaken up politically. And then funny enough, the politician that would come to power after that was from Chicago. That's when Obama was elected in 2008. You know, I think you mentioned that there was a lot going on because of bands, those bands that you mentioned. I think we'd have to put a bullet next to the name of Wilco, because I think that was really important. The knock on effect that they had there in Chicago, like Uncle Tupelo got it started out of St. Louis, and then when Tweedy came to Chicago and Wilco really took off with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, like, that made a big difference. I mean, that album was a really big deal, and specifically in that city, it was a really big deal.
Absolutely, yeah. My folks, my mom used to live, my mom taught in Belleville and whatnot. And so my hometown was like right in between St. Louis and Chicago. So to kind of have the connection there with Wilco coming from, you know, both of these, the North and the South of where I was, it was pretty special. And, I don't know. I still can't really describe their music. I really can't. Yeah. I really can't. But, I think there was definitely, a lot of pride in Chicago that hey, we got the band, man. The band right now is from here. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I remember at that time, so I was a really big fan of Tweedy's, but I am not sophisticated enough to like have Yankee Hotel Foxtrot be my favorite. I was always like an AM guy, which was like, you don't want to admit that in polite company, especially at that time. I was like, I want to listen to Casino Queen, man. People are like, no, man, that's not.
Right. And you know, there's always like a songwriter scene, I think, in Chicago. But when I got there, all my roommates, they were more into like jam music and improvisational music. And they were really into like Umphreys. And, you know, it was cool to see Umphreys like hanging out in Chicago on random nights. And then they, you know, see them like rise from like the small venues to the big theaters and then multiple nights too. And so seeing these things like Wilco and Umphreys and Cornmeal too, just watching these and yourself, you know, watching acts, you know, grow right in front of your eyes. That's a pretty cool scene. I'm not involved probably in the scene enough right now to watch something like that ever again, you know. Maybe I can see it on my screen, but to be right there and witness those things, it's pretty special.
I was in Chicago recently. I played, I'm sure you've played this before, the 4th of July thing at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And, I love that. A friend of both of ours, Will, owns that place. And I was there to play, and I was closing out the night, and, not outside in the little theater thing in there. And I was looking around because, you know, at that point you all kind of share the green room behind the stage there. So I was there with a bunch of the bands that were playing beforehand, and I realized they were all people who were 10 or 15 years younger than me, and they all knew each other. There were all these Chicago bands that played with one another, and someone's bass player also plays keys and this person's band and all that. And it was kind of like this bittersweet thing of like I'm kind of the old guy now, and I don't have a scene like that. I go out and I play a club, and I go home to my wife and kids and hang out there in the suburbs. But but sweet in the sense of the beat is going on. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, people are continuing to do this, and sweet in the sense of I can look back at that time with like true fondness now. Like, there's really fond memories I have of that time.
Yeah. Same. I got there in my car, and I got the old welcome to Chicago gift, which was somebody broke my window and stole a few things out of my car. And I was so green and young and not a gray hair. And now, yeah, I feel like whenever I'm in Chicago, I'm kind of the elder statesman now.
Yeah, I know.
Except I thought when you're like the older statesman, you're supposed to be wiser. I don't know if that's worked out for me yet. But there is a cool young scene up there. And a lot of people are doing that thing. It's kind of like, I know so many Chicago musicians who just never leave Chicago. Yeah. They just stay busy playing in Chicago and playing all these great clubs. And you know, we started off talking about a club closing, and man, some of these have, but some of them are going strong, and God bless them. I'm wearing the Martyrs shirt right now. We're playing up there in April, and it's just still an independent mom and pop thing. Like, this club, they still like cook you food, like right there in the kitchen next to the green room, and bring you out a spread, and just treat you like family. And it really is family. And, you know, I hope that continues for the next generation. I hope they get to see some of the things we saw, and, you know, it's, I don't know.
It sounds like they are. I mean, for the most
part,
life is different, but it sounds like they are. Did you, you know, you were talking about that jam scene, and we had talked earlier about how, you know, Todd had gone out and he was really known for being like kind of strangely enmeshed in that scene as a songwriter. Have you, it seems to me from the outside looking in that you've dabbled in a similar way, like you can kind of cross over and play to that crowd as well as the songwriter crowd.
I didn't dive into the Chicago songwriter scene right away, because my friends were into like festivals and things. And, I, growing up in Central Illinois, I had known Jay Goldberg. Him and my old man were buddies. They put on like Alice Cooper shows back in the day, and used to hang out. And he ran Summer Camp Music Festival in Chillicothe. And he would come to like, when I would play in my hometown, he would come to like my birthday shows and stuff at the bar. And so he was aware of what I was doing. And I think somehow just word got out about it and was kind of like, hey, we're at these festivals, like, raging and getting our faces melted all weekend long. What if we just have this farmer guy, you know, sing his songs and tell his stories, and we'll just stop raging for a minute, and we'll smoke a joint and drink a beer and listen to this guy's songs and stories. And it seemed to work. And it worked, I think, because, you know, most, you go to Nashville or somewhere else, it's like everybody's a guy and a guitar.
Yeah.
But at some of these like jam festivals, I was kind of like, I was unique, you know.
Yeah.
I was a guy with a guitar and a story, singing folk songs, and nobody else at the whole place was doing that, you know. So that, it kind of worked out for me pretty well, really.
Yeah, you were like, a pentatonic scale will not be harmed in this in the making of this concert with me. Now, I really love gigs like that. I love gigs. So if you're headlining a night, and you know this very well, I'd be interested to see how you feel. But when I'm headlining a night and I know I have to play 75 to 90 minutes of music, but not only that, that the whole night hinges on whether I can do the thing that night and make everyone kind of float out of their chairs for a second, feel something different. And 99% of the time that happens, but it's a lot of responsibility. And I,
yeah, absolutely.
If I wake up on a show day, it's the first thing I think about when I wake up in the morning. It's totally different when you're kind of like the setup guy for a band,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Stakes are much lower. Expectations are much less. Set is 35 minutes. I mean, I love those gigs, man. I love them.
Yeah. At summer camp, it was kind of like known as like breakfast with Chicago Farmer. I would play at noon on Sunday before all the big headlining acts. And, you know, there were people that were still sleeping in their tents. There was these hippies that haven't slept in 4 days and they were sleeping in. But yeah, I could just go out there. There's always a little bit of pressure, but there's definitely those gigs where it's not there and you can just kind of have a little more freedom. And yeah, playing breakfast to people at noon on a campfire stage at a festival.
Yeah.
You, knowing that everybody's going to have a great day because The Flaming Lips are playing 8 hours later or something like that, or Todd Snyder and the Hardworking Americans or something like that. You know, that is a good gig, I'll admit.
Yeah. Yeah. And if for some reason if for whatever reason it doesn't work, you're like, all right, I just got 20 more minutes up here. The headlining gig, you're like, I have like over an hour to go, everyone up here. This is going to be,
I'm gonna bomb. Yeah. I just played Eddie's Attic for the first time, and
oh, nice.
I played it on a Monday, and you know, we had a nice little crowd, but it's like, it's a Monday night.
Yeah.
After the Super Bowl. And it's my first time here. It's a lot of pressure. I got to deliver. And, after the gig, there's always a couple of things you wish you would have done differently. But that's after playing, like, that was like my fifth show in 6 days. And we had driven all the way from like Bonita Springs, Florida, and was just fried. And, that pressure, I still got to deliver here on a Monday night because all these people paid $20 to come see this guy supposed to deliver. Yeah, it's a whole trickier thing when you're the headliner.
I remember calling my wife from the road years ago and being like, I've been doing this too long for nobody to come to a show. And this is BS and this, that, and the other. And she was like, cool. Yep, you've been doing this for 15 years now. And pretty much once a month you call me and you complain about no one being there. And every time you make that call, it's a Monday night. And so I'm going to need you to either stop playing Monday nights or never call me again what are you expecting here? I would never go to a show on a Monday night. Like,
it's true. I mean, but you know, it's like, it's Eddie's and I had to get in there and that's what they offer.
Oh, no, totally.
And plus, you know, we were driving home and we could just driven straight home from Jacksonville Beach, or I could, pay for my gas in my hotel.
No, believe me, I know. And like,
believe me, a Monday night gig is not normal on the repertoire.
It's a tough one. And I still play them now and then when it's something like that, like a routing date. But I just know that I'm not allowed to call home and complain, which has been.
Wives are smart. Mine's upstairs working right now, laughing at me because I had technological problems earlier. she's an online teacher, so yeah.
Well, I try very hard to not repeat poems on this podcast, but to have Cody from Delavan, Illinois on the show today, Chicago farmer himself, there's no other poem that is suitable besides Wendell Berry's legendary work, Manifesto, The Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance, for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that prophet. Prophecy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to the carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie down in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. In Chicago, like you were talking about how you're in some ways your mind was kind of blown by the size and scope of the city and also kind of the cultural depth of all these other artists that you were encountering. What kind of metamorphosis were you going under as a writer at that point? What were you starting to learn about writing songs? What were you getting better at? What were some habits that you had to let go of?
Man, I was just constantly writing at the time. Honestly, I wish I still was writing as much as I did back then now, honestly. I still had that fire in my, I still do now. I don't write as often, but, you know, it was cool to just, whenever I go to a different environment, I'm writing new things.
Yeah.
You know, and pretty much when I got to Chicago, all my songs were small town driven. And so now I have this whole new, you know, canvas of a whole new place with whole new people and whole new struggles to go from. And I think that's really when I started kind of tapping into just people on the street. You know, we didn't have a homeless population in Delavan, Illinois, but we do right there in Wicker Park. We have addiction in Central Illinois, but it's kind of a different kind of addiction than what people have in the city. So I think I was just tapping in more on my characters. I was developing a lot more characters that were different than my small town rural characters. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, it was eye-opening and fun, but man, Chicago's hard. And I was writing about the hardships of Chicago. I'd play a gig for $50 and I would go to my car and have a ticket on my windshield for $35 and just, you know, constant, expenses of living in a city and getting around. It inspired a lot of writing and a lot of music.
Man, you just jogged a memory of mine. I remember playing Bowery Ballroom in New York City, and in the advance for that show, as to where to park, they said, come in, park in a loading thing right in front of our theater, load in, and then don't move your van because it will cost more to move your van and park it somewhere else in Manhattan than it will be to just take the ticket. The ticket's like $100 and parking's like 150.
Yeah, they don't make it easy on us, you know. No. But those things create stories and songs, I suppose.
I guess so. You know, it's funny that you were saying that moving to the new place made such a difference in writing. I've always found that before I had kids, I pretty much recorded records in different studios in different towns every time, because I always felt like a slightly different person when I was there, and I always felt that to be very helpful. I can't do that right now in this season of life because I travel so much to play shows. I can't travel to record too, but I do look forward to later in life, God willing, that I'm still healthy. I think I'll travel to make records again. I think it makes a really big difference.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that different environment, the different setting. We've been in this house. We've been in Bloomington now for several years. We've been in this house for 5 or 6 years, but there was a stretch there where we moved like 9 or 10 times. And I feel like in that first 2 weeks of moving into a new home, I was writing new songs. I don't know what it is, but yeah. And we just went and made this record, our latest record, in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. Having never been in Cannon Falls, Minnesota in my life, it's just where the studio recommended to be and where the producer was. And just as soon as we got there, you know, in this new setting, you know, new ideas in a new place just started bouncing around and new vibes and new inspirations. And there's nothing like home, and you can always, you know, you can close your eyes and go anywhere, but, you know, experiencing new places seems to always get the waterfalls flowing for songs.
Yeah, it really does. There is something about being home and you kind of get an idea and you're thinking about, well, am I going to sit down for an hour and a half here and finish this song, or am I going to go get tacos? And, you know, just knowing, well, like, you know, the little workspace down here, this will be here tomorrow. This is here all the time. It's been here for 10 years. You know, hopefully it'll be here for another 10 or 20. So maybe I'll go get tacos. But maybe, you know, something about being in that different place, you're like, no, I'm here to do this thing right now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, I got this guy, he's a friend and he's kind of a fan. His name's Mark. He lives in Cincinnati. And every time I go play in Cincinnati, first thing he asks me is, how are you? How's your wife? How's the dog? And then he asks me, do you have anything new? And I'm like, most of the time I do, but I remember one time I was like, no, I don't have any new songs tonight. And he was cool about it. He's like, well, I dig all your old stuff, but I could tell he was a little disappointed I didn't have something new. So, I am the same guy who prefers tacos over writing a song, just like, you know, Brian, I think, preferred a hot dog. But anymore, I kind of demand that if I'm going somewhere, you know, twice a year, I got to bring new material. And so that forces me to write at home, even though I don't want to, I think.
Man, the thing that kills me even more is stepping out on a stage. I try to come back to a place about once every 18 months, and I'll step on a stage there. And the thing that gets me even worse is if I step on stage and I see someone in the audience who I knew was there last time, and I was like, dang, well, not only am I going to play a lot of the same songs, but I got a couple jokes I have to tell here that I'm not going to pull the punches on this. I got to tell the joke. So having to tell the joke to someone that you know has been there before kind of kills you too.
Yeah, it does, man. But, you know, it's not like the days at Filter where you're just, you know, one song after another. I remember driving to gigs and writing songs.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and they weren't great, but they entertained somebody. They made them smile, and it was something different than what they saw the week before when I was doing like a weekly residency or something like that. And I don't know. I think the songs are definitely better, but man, they seem harder. They seem harder to come by.
They do. I can remember writing, you know, on the way to gigs or having just written something. And even the song that's been the most successful for me, Hymn 101, I remember playing it that day at Lily's. I played it the day that I wrote it. And all the lyrics at that time were like, I've come to this, I've come to that, I've come to this. And then in the recorded version of the song, once per verse, I'll like kind of hold out the word, and I've come. And the reason for that is I was on stage that night and I'd written it that day and I'd forgotten what the next thing that I had just written was. So I had to hold think come until I remembered. And so that obviously makes it a better song. And it never would have happened if I had written it now, because I would have written it now in my basement. Then I would have recorded it. And if I'd forgotten what the lyric was, I would have pressed the space bar to stop recording and looked up what the thing was. And different energy then, man.
Yeah, definitely. I think the songs that I have now on my new record, I wrote them all, you know, here in this little basement where I'm talking to you now. But they definitely evolve, you know, from playing them live.
Yes.
And so, you know, there are, you know, I was here like, people will go, like Steve Earle will just go into a studio and write a song and record it. And, you know, he's also Steve Earle. But for me, the songs kind of have to evolve, especially with the band, because the band comes up with new different little parts and new little things that color in parts that I love as they go on. So, but the problem with that, though, is like now these songs are coming on a record and I've already been playing them for quite a while.
I know.
People know the songs, but I guess now they're getting to hear the recorded version, which is different, but you know.
I know. Well, it looks like, so this is your first full length in 5 or 6 years. I know you had an EP in between. Was there a reason? It looks like this has been your longest break between LPs.
Yeah, I recorded an album called Flyover Country in 2019 with the Band of Heathens.
That's
so,
right.
Like, hopped on a plane with our old friend Chris Harden. I remember Chris Harden. And flew down to Austin and locked ourselves in the studio with the Heathens for about 4 or 5 days and had a blast making that record and felt really good about it. And we got to tour in January and February of 2020, and then the whole world shut down.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm kind of one of those guys who, empties out their bank account to make a record and then try to hit the road to recoup it. And there was just not a lot of time to recoup. So I was like, I need a break from recording. And I think the EP was forced a little bit just because I had a new band. I wanted to get in the studio. But this one, we actually, for the first time, had a producer and really thought it out a little bit. Yeah. I kind of had a plan, Joe. Yeah. And I think it worked out. I think it was worth the wait. I'm not going to wait as long next time, but that's kind of why the big gap there in between recordings.
Yeah. Well, no, I feel you, man. It's like, I'd like to get them out at a faster clip too, but at the same time, it's like, with recording and paying salaries and manufacturing, and then obviously you got to market it if you're going to put all that money into it. It's like, oh yeah, right. I guess I'll just use this spare 30 or 40K that I just had sitting in a checking account. It's like, no, it's not how this works at all, man.
Yeah. I'm very fortunate. I got a label called Lo-Hi Records, which I really love, and they're helping me with some of it. So that helps. But even with them throwing in like half, you know, it's like the other half is just, it's kind of mind boggling sometimes.
It is.
And over time, it might not seem like a lot, but when you see those numbers, like right in front of your face at the moment, it can be a little downtrodden and devastating to you.
It's a cash flow because ultimately it'll be an asset that you'll have for the rest of your life and that even sure. your posterity yeah. would. So it's totally worth it, but it's the cash pinch in that moment. I don't use AI for a lot of stuff, but I thought it would be good for this. And I'm trying to work on several releases for later this year. And I just know I'm used to the cash pinch coming. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm like, ChatGPT, teach me about cash flow. How does cash flow work? You are my teacher. I'm going to business school. Teach me about this. And so that's kind of taken a little bit of the mystery away from it, because it's not that complicated. It's just like you got to outlay a lot of money now. So how are you going to survive and to the point when you start getting revenues back in? And there's ways to do it. I'm ashamed that it took me to age 41 to even think about learning about it. But here we are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you do that record with the Heathens at finishing school in?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Man, yeah. Dude, that place used to be owned by this bass player, great bass player named George Reef, who died well before his time. He got cancer out of nowhere. But I did a couple, not albums down there, but there was a couple albums that I did where it was like, you know, you finish it and then everyone's like, yeah, but we don't have that song yet. Can you go record that song? And so we went and did a couple down there. I'd like that little, just that little suburban house of a studio. Yeah. It's sweet.
Yeah, I didn't get to meet George, but the Heathens and Gordy obviously loved him very much and had a lot of praise for him. And it was a special place. I'm glad they're keeping it going. And
yeah.
Yeah, I feel bad. We didn't really get to see much of Austin. We just locked ourselves in there. And then at night, there in one of those little side rooms was a Murphy bed you pull out of the wall.
Yeah.
And we would crash and then wake up the next morning and the Heathens would show up again and we'd start recording again. But
well, it's good.
But it was a great vibe and a cool experience.
It's good you locked yourself in, because if there was ever a city where the tacos from that city could make you not write a song, it would be Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man, congrats on the new record, and
thank
I can't
so
believe
much.
It took us so long to do this together. Let's do another episode soon. This was a blast.
I would love it. Thank you so much for having me.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Chicago Farmer's latest album is entitled Homemade. Available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.